Laurie Murdoch, you have one of the great roles in the musical theater, but look at your career. You've spent an awful lot of time in TV shows and movies.
I have. I've been actually very fortunate to mix it up that way. I didn't do a lot of TV when I was younger, but because I don't really look specific enough, I think, for television. Television needs you to, the audience needs to know who you are as soon as you walk on the, are you a good guy, a bad guy, you know. And I sort of had a, sort of, I guess, a malleable look. But then suddenly when I turned about 35, they went, oh, okay, you're an aging white man, we understand. And and suddenly I started getting jobs as petulant weasels on television, sort of a mean, small man in charge that nobody likes. So I rode that out for a while, and I had a lot of fun. I don't do as much TV as I used to, and I'm doing a lot more stage now. And like you say, Pinafore is just, I had never done Gilbert and Sullivan, never seen a Gilbert and Sullivan before, and I'm just having the time of my life.
When you were doing, like, Warehouse 13, were you going off to the side of the stage and running the scales up and down to keep your voice up?
Oh, I wish I were that dedicated. my voice kind of likes it to take a break, actually. And I find I have a lot more enthusiasm for it when I come back into it. If I've laid off it and gone into, I have kind of a wide range of interests anyway, and I tend to plunge into whatever I'm in, and then when I get back into my next musical, then I'm all that more excited to break it out.
You're doing a Gilbert and Sullivan with Pinafore, and you're doing one of the classic musicals with Guys and Dolls. Is it difficult to do two musicals up here?
Yes. that's the truthful answer. I mean, it's difficult from an energy standpoint. Because, for instance, today we have, we do a Pinafore this afternoon, and then we do Guys and Dolls in the evening. So you pretty, at a certain age, you have to guard your energy jealously and make sure that you are up to it.
At one point, Brian McDonald had built almost a company up here doing Gilbert and Sullivan musicals year after year, and then the festival got away from it. Is it hard for someone who, as you said, has not much experience with Gilbert and Sullivan to come in and do these very unusual musicals?
Actually, that's what I would have thought would have been the case, but as I've done it, I've realized that Gilbert and Sullivan is the root of much of what we consider to be musical theater and even comedy today. They owe Monty Python, the call and response song, the show that has songs that move the plot along with the spoken word. It's all the root of what we do today. And so I found it quite simple because it's the basis.
How about Guys and Dolls? That's a much later show.
Yes, but it is so iconic that you know instantly what it is. There have been so many movies, TV shows, plays about that kind of, or that era of New York, and that it's really not foreign territory for anyone who hasn't lived in a cave.
When you're doing a musical, what kind of, you said you've watch your energy level, but how much exercise and how much good behavior do you have to do when you're doing a musical?
For me, it's pretty much all-consuming. You're from the moment you wake up in the morning to when you go to bed, is you have to have your eye on how you feel, and you're watching for any voice problems. You're watching for especially. I'm 59, and a muscle problem that would have lasted for 3 days 25 years ago lasts for 3 months now, and they can build up on you. And of course, the shows have a lot of movement, a lot of dancing, and so it really, it's rather like being an athlete. You just have to treat yourself very, very well. And I don't even have a lot of time for exercising. I ride my bike in this beautiful little city. I ride my bike to work back and forth, and I walk, and that's about all the exercise I get.
I noticed last night in Pinafore, there were a number of times when you kind of backed toward the back of the stage and let the the chorus danced like mad, but you seem to have pulled back a little bit.
I couldn't be happier about that. Yeah, there's a couple of places where he's, this character, Sir Joseph Porter, they're basically putting on a show for him. They're trying to fool him into thinking that they're behind him. And so there are a couple of points where I get to just sit back and watch them all entertain me, which is great from two standpoints. It's great from an acting standpoint, and it's great from my body.
This show is staged as a wraparound, the story of the Naval Hospital in the middle of World War I. And the festival here has done this before. They did it a few years ago with A Midsummer Night's Dream. Do you like that way of approaching the show? I mean, would you have preferred a straight-on HMS Pinafore?
From my standpoint, I enjoy it because the prologue is just a way to dip your toe in the water as far as just getting your energy up and getting ready to do the show. So it's really kind of like an energizer that I get. I'm fortunate because I do the prologue and then I get, I think, 22 minutes to get ready for my entrance. So I knock the prologue off and then go prepare. And it's really quite a nice setup for me.
Did you do any research on Gilbert and Sullivan? I mean, there have been all kinds of books. You have the movie Topsy Turvy. Just all kinds of stuff out there. But Gilbert and Sullivan isn't done a lot anymore because there are questions about some of his shows. Nobody's going to do Mikado, for example.
Correct,
the cultural appropriation issue.
Yeah.
What kind of research did you do?
Well, I listened to the song. I found the song quite so easy now to go, you know, find someone singing the song. Well, one of the points earlier I made was that you don't even really realize how much Gilbert and Sullivan has crept into your consciousness because it's the basis of so much that we do. And it's been on The Simpsons. Like, there was an episode of The Simpsons where Bart, he's going to be killed by Sideshow Bob, and he says, "Do you have any last requests?" And he says, "Yes, would you please sing the entire score of HMS Pinafore?" And so he does. they shorten it down. No, I didn't research it a lot. I'd seen Topsy Turvy years ago, and it just felt like a good fit because I was a big Monty Python fan, and it seemed like it's kind of hard to describe, but it seemed like I knew it, even though I didn't.
A lot of people have told me this is a good place to do any kind of a show, whether a musical or a non-musical show, because you guys get a lot of rehearsal time. Did you find that helped?
It does. You know, you look at the amount of rehearsal you get at a place like Stratford, and you go, how are we going to fill our time? How are we going to do it? And then sure enough, time approaches to open the show, and you're thinking, where did it go? But it is, it's a great gift here. You are rehearsing two shows at once, some people three. So that's a different technique, a different trick to try to keep two shows straight in your mind. Because for me, there are a couple of lines in both shows that are similar. And so I'll get up there and have to really go over it before I go out there and remember which of these lines it is that I'm doing. To be ready to go by the time you get your first audience, excuse me, to be like you're like a racehorse and you're ready to go. You need that audience and you're ready to go. As opposed to some situations in theater across the country where when you go out for your first audience, you're just thinking, well, maybe this will be the first time I do it right. I don't know. And here it's a far different matter.
Is it physically or vocally different if you're rehearsing two shows like this? I mean, do you do one in the morning and one in the afternoon and you stop at lunch and say, oh, 50s New York, not 1917 Portsmouth?
Yeah, that happens. Usually you get an entire day dedicated to one show. There are times where you will do one show in the rehearse one show in the morning and then switch to the other in the afternoon. But generally, you have some time. You have an hour, like lunch, after lunch or something like that, so you can sort of get your head around it
During a day of rehearsal, how much time is Sir Joseph Porter on stage?
Well, that would depend on the day. I mean, some days, you know, as they work on, say, the number or the scene before you, you could show up at 10 o'clock in the morning and, you know, be ready to go for 10:15, but there's some sort of problem and you could end up sitting around for an hour or an hour and a half waiting for them to solve the problem that they're trying to solve. And then sometimes you can be working on your number and you are singing constantly for 2 hours, which is great because it builds your stamina up. Because in the real world, in the real show, you don't have to sing the song over and over again for 2 hours. It's very hard on the voice and can be very tiring, but it really builds up your strength.
Is it psychologically different if you're suddenly then the next day doing Guys and Dolls?
It is. But I find it quite refreshing. After you get past the there's always a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of worry that you're standing there waiting to walk on the stage and the music has started and you're going, do I know this? I'm really enjoying it now because it breaks up your week and it keeps you from getting stale in either of the shows. It does. The price you pay, though, is like every time you are doing, every time you've flipped and done a new show, at least for me, I have to sit there and go over my entire show in my head before I go out there.
Well, when you're doing a TV show, how much rehearsal time do you get, or do you just have to have your lines down as opposed to having to do 8 shows a week here?
Generally with TV, now TV, especially in the last 20 years or so, has become squeezed and squeezed and squeezed for money, and so the time has become less and less. There was never any really rehearsal of a scene, but you would get up, you usually hold the script for the very first time, and you run the scene, you get the blocking, you know where to go, so then you put it down, and then you have maybe a couple more times through it for the camera, for sound. Everybody knows what they're doing. You get maybe 3 kicks at it before you shoot it. So it's a far different experience.
But if you get called back for other shows, that suggests you did it right in those 3 kicks.
I guess, or maybe they didn't hear about the first one.
But that's got to be an issue also. You got to produce in theater or TV or whatever. If you get a bad reputation, you aren't going to get hired.
Well, you'd think so. You know, we all know stories of misbehaving stars who seem to work constantly. And from that standpoint, I guess if you're bringing money in, you're going to get hired. But from the workaday world of most actors, where you're just, lunch pail actor who shows up every day, yeah, you don't get many strikes because it's quite a small community, and by the time you've made a couple of mistakes, most of the people have heard about you and they'll move on to the next, move on to the next guy because they don't want to take a chance.
You're in the full flow of the summer here in Stratford. You're doing the 2 musicals. How many auditions do you go to at this time of year for your next show?
I haven't had, I don't think I've had any auditions, actually. Are you speaking of auditions for next year here, or?
We'll get to next year. Oh, okay. How about for this fall when the season closes here?
I do have a job for the fall lined up, thank goodness. So no worry there. No, I really haven't. I really haven't had a lot of, thank goodness, a lot of auditions to worry about because the workload's pretty solid here. Just to keep yourself healthy and ready to go.
Now, Kate Hennig has dealt with the ever present shortage of acting roles by writing her own plays. And she's in an unusual situation this year. She's got to play here, and she's got to play at Niagara-on-the-Lake for the Shaw Festival. What do you do to get ready for next year? Or do you go to Anthony and say, do you have room for this particular role in this particular show?
Well, not yet. I mean, we don't really know what the season is next year. So it's hard to you can't really do that from that standpoint. I write as well. I'm a musician. I play banjo and write the odd tune. I just like to I have quite a broad base, and I would actually like to get a period of time where I could get back into auditioning for film and TV again, because it's been a while, and you do tend to lose your edge quite quickly with camera work after you've done a lot of stage work, because your performance, I would say, the focal point of your performance tends to blast out to the back wall of the room rather than to where the focal point of the lens is, and that's something you really have to relearn. Every now and then, every couple of years, I like to reconnect with it and remember how to do it.
Well, are you using mics in either of your musicals this season?
Both, actually. Both musicals use microphones, yeah, with a very small mic that's usually over the ear or hidden under a wig just on the forehead.
Well, does that affect... You know, the old story was stage actors going to movies, they shout, at least as far as the microphone is concerned.
Yeah.
Do you have to worry about that?
In TV, you mean? Or
yes.
Yeah, you do have to. It's almost like it's a different craft, actually. You have to change completely your approach to the performance, because for film or TV, the camera is like a very good friend of yours who's leaning in and listening to what you're saying. And in a theater, especially like this magnificent festival theater that's 2,000 seats, you really can't get too small. And even though we're mic'd, they don't want it to sound like it's coming over a microphone. So you have to produce enough sound that the audience knows it's coming from you, so that your voice doesn't appear to be coming out of a speaker. And the sound people are brilliant here to... So that the microphone boosts just a little bit, just to get you over the orchestra, but you have to produce enough to have live sound, to have actual sound reaching the audience's ears from your voice. That's the main focus.
One of the things about the theaters here, you're doing Pinafore at the Avon, which is a standard proscenium arch kind of stage, and the audience is just out there. You do a show here in the Festival Theater. You have to move almost constantly on stage because the audience almost surrounds you. Does that get difficult?
Oh, it's a real... I've been 40 years in the business. This is my first thrust stage. So it was... And Donna Fior, the director, was very, very knowledgeable and very aware of that. And, it adds another... It's almost like a three-dimensional chess game. Because with the thrust stage, you have to make sure you're not blocking anybody, and you have to make sure that everybody can see you. So you have to constantly do sort of micro adjustments in your blocking to make sure that you've got the other person lined up with an aisle or a gap, so that you can always be seen, especially if you're speaking. You know, after 40 years in the business, it was actually fantastic to be thrown into a situation where I was really quite unfamiliar with how to do it. It was new, and I enjoyed it.
Well, Donna's danced on this stage. She understands this.
She does. She knows it. She knows it cold. Yeah.
Thank you, Laurie Murdoch.
Thank you very much.